Okay, we're going to gossip right now with the cool scientists. It's good for us.
Yeah, it is good for us.
Hear about.
Well, it makes me feel good to think it's good for us because I like gossip. I think a lot of people like gossip if they admit it.
Why is it good for us?
Well, it's good for us because it gives us information about other people in a way that we have to know how to trust other people. So, you know, if you're in a big group of people in a big organization or group of friends, you need to know who you can trust. In fact, they think that gossiping really dates way back to when we went from being going around in small bands of people into much larger groups, because once we went beyond our friends and our immediate friends and family, we had to know, well, is that person trustworthy? Is that person trustworthy? So that's one thing. Who do we trust? Also, to mark out the cheaters, because society has certain rules. So if somebody is cheating, you know, you need to let others know, because then the cheater will get away with it, and we certainly don't want that. So there have been fascinating things found. Like, for example, people get very stressed when they see somebody breaking the rules, but that stress dissipates when they actually pass on the information that they rat, right, if you like, and pass on the information to others. So
so you feel a little community of people who are annoyed.
Exactly, yeah. Now, gossip, of course, it has a very negative kind of connotation, but doesn't necessarily have to be. And research also shows that we don't, I'm talking in general now, we don't like people who gossip too much, because maybe that can be destructive. But also, we don't like people who don't gossip at all, because we don't trust them either. So we get the majority of us, the in the middle people, we like people who gossip a little, because it also helps to establish bonds and friendships, you know, because if you've got a friend, one way of bonding with your friend is to give them a little bit, a tidbit of information about what's going on, and that establishes a connection.
You're in with the in crowd.
You're in with the in crowd, yeah, exactly. So yeah, gossip is really, and language, we're speaking now, right? That's one thing that distinguishes us from all other creatures. They think, evolutionary biologists, that language evolves. The reason it exists was to facilitate gossip. So we were there at a very early stage, and our language skills developed because we needed to know, as we went from groups of 20 up to 150, or whatever, roaming around the plains, that we had to know who to trust in a stressful situation, and that language was facilitated that, because it gave us the ability to do this gossiping.
Very good.
You go.
Another development that you're going to bring to our notice is the first biolimb.
Yeah, the first biolimb. So there have been lots of developments in robotics recently, and these amazing limbs that are being created. They used to, if we think back, limbs used to look very basic, but now the movement in these bionic limbs is incredible. They've also done things where people have had hand transplants after accidents and stuff like that. So that's been going on for a while. But a biolimb is different. A biolimb is something that actually would look normal, like a regular limb. And the way they're doing it is, I initially thought it was stem cells. It's not stem cells. They've done it in rats, okay? They haven't done it in humans. That's the first thing to say. But they took a forearm, from your elbow down to the tip of your fingers. And they basically took this from one rat who had died, and they gave it to another rat. And what they did was, it sounds horrific, like Frankenstein, but they essentially took the soft tissue off the forelimb, and then they reseeded soft tissue from the recipient rat that was getting it. So it regrew all this tissue and basically was attached on to the rat recipient. Why did they do that? Well, if you get a limb, like a hand transplant, you have to take immunosuppressant drugs for the rest of your life. These are drugs that essentially, for the rest of your life after you get a hand transplant from a donor, your body is recognizing that hand as alien and wants it out of there completely. So it's prepared to attack that limb. So you have to take drugs to dampen that down that can have side effects. This limb will be treated as part of the body because it has your own cells on top of it. Also, it looks an awful lot better. It doesn't look like a robotic or bionic limb. They've done it with lots of things. They've done it with hearts, lungs, windpipes, now forelimbs. So maybe this is the way of the future, that, you know, we'll still need our donors, but we'll be able to see them with our own cells, and it'll be more like our own.
You can imagine what the next 50 years is going to bring up.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's incredible. Now, yeah. I mean, there is that side to it, but also there's another thing that could go in parallel, which is actually growing organs using your own stem cells. So I'm not sure which you'll get there first. This is working. They attached it on to the rat, and they had to, of course, figure out, is this going to work? So they sent electrical pulses into it, and it flexed and closed and everything, so it was working in that sense. And also they saw that blood flowed into the new limb. So it looks like it works. But it's going to be at least 10 years before we see one in humans.
Very good. It's the cool scientist, Sean Duke, is going to tell us in just a second why the eyes have it.
The Morning Show on East Coast FM.
The Morning Show.
With Declan Meehan.
With thanks to Wicklow Hire and Hardware. Do it yourself. Do it for less.
Cool scientist Sean Duke is here. Now look into my eyes. The eyes have it. Is that right?
Yeah, this is scary now because you could actually read a lot from people's eyes. We suspected this anyway, but science is now proving it. And we're giving away lots of information. If you care to look, there are all different kinds of eye movements that are going on all the time. Some of them are conscious. Some of them are unconscious. We look at people. We look away when we think. We look up and away if we're lying. If our eyes are dilated, it can indicate that we might have taken drugs. There's all kinds of information there if you choose to look. So scientists have got it. And rapid eye movements when we're asleep, we've heard of those. So for example, one of the things that the scientists, they decided to look at this and try and find out what can we find out about the eyes. And they found if your eyes are dilated, which happens when you've taken drugs, but also without the drug thing, it indicates that you're less decisive in what decision that you're going to make. So if you're in a business situation and you happen to be clued into this and you saw somebody's pupils dilated, so they're quite large, you know that the person facing you is actually a little bit indecisive here. So maybe you can go in for the kill.
Okay.
And also, I mean, really good salespeople would pick up on, you know, they just have an instinct for the moment when somebody wavers and then they offer them something and then they may close the deal. Okay, so that's one thing. There are lots of other things that they've looked at. They've looked at, fascinatingly, if you look up and to the right, you're going to choose a number in a series that's bigger, rather than if you look up and to the left and choose a number that's lower.
Seriously,
Yeah, they've done that. They actually did that because they played around with it and they tried to figure out, okay, can we anticipate decisions that people are going to make by looking at their eyes? And of course, this is really valuable information for sales, for when you're selling things or when you're trying to give messages about various things. But think of all the people, politicians, that would be interested in this. This is... Alongside this, there's this eye tracking technology that's going on, which is fascinating. And I did a story on this recently. So again, there are sinister sides to science and there are positive sides to science. The positive side on this eye thing is that there was a guy that I interviewed and he was in a bed and he basically couldn't move anything except for his eyes. So they'd set up this technology where he could communicate with the outside world by just looking at certain letters on a screen. The machine would see what he's looking at. It's called eye tracking, and he could send an email. And they were working on something where he could talk and he could control his television. He could do things that he couldn't do. He's just lying there. So that's the positive side. The negative side is that you could influence people's decisions in a disturbing way, actually. And they looked at, for example, moral decision making. So they presented people with a series of moral situations, like would it be right to kill a person in a certain situation, for example, if they did something or other. And most people would, under normal circumstances, to say no. But if you put them in front of a screen and you flashed certain options that said, well, maybe if this, maybe if that, you could encourage them towards making a particular decision that they wouldn't normally make. So it's kind of like the subliminal messaging thing that's going on. So we have to be very careful now because we have these apps as well on our phones and our smartphones that can monitor you.
My phone stays on as long as I look at it.
Yeah, exactly. So that thing could be used, and it's got a camera there, it could be used to watch you as you do your online shopping, okay? So now the people out there are thinking, right, we know what you're at. If you're looking at something and your eyes are dilating, they know you're humming and hawing and that you're maybe ripe for the kill. And they can then, at that moment, you could have an app that says, right, I'm like a salesman, I'm going to offer you a discount on that thing that you're looking at. And they could build this into the apps. So this is where it's going. It's fascinating, you know. So beware of the apps.
You guys are too dangerous. Is the cool scientist Sean Duke, and finally, creative people are more likely to suffer from mental illness.
Yeah, so psychiatrists have kind of poo-pooed this and said, you know, that this is a bit of a cliche, that we have this very strong image of creative people's, like, I suppose, Van Gogh, that cut off his ear. And there's lots of examples of these tortured geniuses that were very creative and were also mentally ill. But here's some science. The science, what does the science say? Well, they looked at this in Iceland. It's a small country, but it's fascinating because they have this project called DECODE, where they look at all the genetic information from all of the Icelanders. It's the only place in the world where they have an entire country that people have agreed to offer their genetic information for studies of all kinds. So you see all kinds of stuff coming out of Iceland, and that's the reason for it. Now, they looked at, there's certain genes that we know now are linked with schizophrenia, and they're very strongly, and genes that are strongly linked with bipolar. So they did a survey of using this information from this DECODE project, and they found that up to a quarter people that were creative, that were regarded as creative, which they said were painters, dancers, there was a list of categories, I think writers were in there, all of those people, they compared those people to all the other people, and they found that the creative types, if you like, had a 25% more chance, 25% more likely to have these genes for schizophrenia and for bipolar. So there's the first evidence that actually suggests that there is a link. Psychiatrists are saying, some of the leading psychiatrists are saying, hang on a second, you know, this needs to be proved. But I mean, this is 86,000 people, which is a lot. So there's something significant there.
Right. And maybe the reason they are creative is because they have this...
They have to think
propensity.
Differently.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like if you're conventional, you're going to think in a conventional way. That's not creative. So you're going to be, but you have to think outside the box because you maybe have that type of personality. That leaves you, that's a gift, but it leaves you vulnerable to this other thing as well. So,
all right. Sean Duke, the cool scientist. Thanks for all those this morning. If you want to find out what Sean is writing about, it's seanduke.com, and you'll find all his science spinning that's going on there. Good man yourself,
thanks,
Sean.
Thanks, Declan. Thanks a lot.
Good topics this week. Very good. Thank you.